House Committee on Land Use. Give a moment for everybody to find their seat, and we will start today with an informational meeting in regarding Measure 37 appraisals, and ask Matthew Larrabee, who's already there sitting before us. Good afternoon, Mr. Larrabee, and welcome.
Good afternoon, Chair Villard, and thank you, Chair, for the opportunity to come here and speak to the committee. Hopefully my remarks will be informative and help with your decision making. For your information also, I've prepared a written summary of my remarks, which are available also. My name is Matthew Larrabee, MAI. I'm an appraiser of commercial real estate. I appraise large tracts of land. I'm based in Portland, but I serve the Portland metro area, the North Coast counties, and all of Oregon. I'm also an instructor of real estate appraisal for the Appraisal Institute and for Melrose University in Portland. With regards to appraisal, just a brief two-minute explanation of what appraisers do and who they are. An appraiser is somebody who is independent, impartial, and objective. And an appraisal is a well-informed opinion of value based on knowledge of the subject property and the market. Real estate appraisers are organized into a professional discipline with established standards of practice, recognized valuation techniques. The appraisal, particularly of vacant land, in most cases we are going to be dealing with vacant land or some additional improvement to land in Measure 37 cases, there are different ways to approach the question of value. One way would be to find, and we're on the bottom of page one right now of the handout, one way would be to find a sales comparables that are similar to the subject in terms of their physical and other characteristics. That's not always possible, and is not always the only way to do it or the best way. At times, particularly if we're dealing with land division, where we're going to break a property up into, say, a subdivision, there's another method known as the development method or subdivision method, and this requires a little bit more thorough analysis. And going on to page two, real property is described as a bundle of rights associated with real estate, and that's really what we appraise. We appraise the value of the real property, of what you can or cannot do with a piece of property is what makes its value, in other words, its utility. Within the state of Oregon, appraisal is regulated by law, and by state law only a certified general appraiser, a certified residential appraiser, or a licensed appraiser, a licensed residential appraiser, is allowed to give an opinion of value. There are certain limited exceptions to the licensure law for attorneys, architects, engineers, CPAs, and so on in the course of their own practice. But it's particularly important to note that real estate brokers are prohibited from offering opinions of value or offering testimony as expert value witnesses. They are limited to offering value opinions for the purpose of procuring a listing agreement so that the owner knows what price to sell. Okay. But otherwise, because of their position, they're generally not considered to be independent, impartial, or objective with respect to valuation. Okay. On page three, just briefly, we have three levels of licensing and certification within the state of Oregon under our laws. State general certified appraisers are the only group who are allowed to offer opinions of value without restriction as to type of property or complexity of the assignment. Only state-certified general appraisers are qualified to appraise properties involving divisions of land and also a commercial, industrial, multifamily, or potential multifamily uses over four units, agriculture, mining, and other non-residential properties where the transaction value exceeds $250,000. The other two categories, the state-certified residential appraisers and state-licensed appraisers, are primarily for the purpose of appraising residential real estate. And 95% of the time, that means a single improved house on a single piece of property, a single loan. The role of the appraiser, bottom of page three, is protection of the public interest. We help protect the interests of the lending industry, making sure that the loans have sufficient security. We assess buyer, assist buyers and sellers in setting prices. We assist in resolving questions of value between landlords and tenants, investment partners, spouses, and beneficiaries to estates. Going on to page four, we also, in the public interest, are estimating market value properties taken in condemnation, assisting courts in deciding how to award just compensation so that the claims of the property owner, the condemnee, are protected, and also so that the public interest is protected and the proper amount, not too much, not too little, is awarded to the claimant. I'd like to think we could also be of assistance. Our profession can be of assistance with Measure 37 cases, helping to assure both property owners and the public and governmental jurisdictions that if there is a value question, that it's decided with proper methodology and is a credible opinion of value. As appraisers, we have to abide by what are called uniform standards of professional appraisal practice. Our board, the Appraiser Certification and Licensure Board, is empowered to levy civil fines, revoke licenses, or occasionally appraisers have even had to face criminal prosecution for failure to abide by those standards. So it's something that our profession does take quite seriously. Now, going to the question of what Measure 37 appraisals might entail, the bottom of page 4, they are essentially what we would call in the profession a before and after evaluation. We're not referring to a date when we say before and after. What we're referring to is the comparison between, say, a property. Say we had 25 acres and we're appraising it in the before condition under all the current regulations. So that it's rather limited. Maybe there's not even a house allowed on it. In what we would call the after, in this case, it would be after Measure 37, without those regulations in place, without specific regulations that might limit the land division capability or other uses. So we need to really appraise the same property twice. We're appraising it as of a current date of value, and we're comparing the value with or without the development potential. This involves, even the most simple of these appraisals will have to involve the analysis of complex land use regulations. And in the state of Oregon, we have multiple layers of land use regulations we need to consider for properties, and they're all unique. We also need to sort out what is a state and what is a federal protection of, say, a wetland or a wetland buffer area or a streamside setback. That might also require, of course, the assistance of an expert land use attorney to help give us instructions to figure that out. On page 5, without getting too technical, anytime you appraise land, one of the most important questions is, what can you do with it? And our phrase for what you can do with it is called highest and best use. You look at the physical constraints on a property. Is the topography right? Will accept septic system? Is groundwater available for wells? Can you put roads on it that a fire truck is capable of supporting a fire truck? Other questions like that where you need to meet health and safety issues for development. There's the legal limitations. Of course, we'll be looking at that in two different scenarios, with all the regulations in place or removing certain specified regulations under the claim. And then finally, and maybe most importantly, is understanding the characteristics of the market. We're on page 5 right now. It's not enough just to say, okay, we could put 10 house lots on our property, and so if they're worth $100,000 each, then we have $1 million in value, don't we? The market doesn't work that way. People who purchase vacant land for development don't think that way. They need to look at supply and demand, financial feasibility, and how quickly the market can absorb a particular type of development. Without getting too complex, we have to consider the time value of money. If you build a large subdivision, how quickly market can absorb it and what the discount would be for that. Now, at the bottom of the page 5, in addition to considering how the market will accept the product or the development, appraisal work of this type often involves coordination of expert sub-consultants, such as civil engineers who can work with cost estimates, geologists who can assess the suitability of the soils, private planning consultants who can lay out a meaningful diagram for development, wetlands consultants, sanitary engineers, well drillers, and others. on page 6. I think what's also important is the question of if a government agency decides that it is not really quite willing to waive or really wants to have some more information about the claim itself, there is a process called review appraisal. A review appraisal is an appraisal in which the subject of the appraisal is the quality of the appraisal itself. In other words, a jurisdiction might send out the claimant's appraisal so that appraisal can be judged as to its adequacy and credibility. I think that review appraisal can be a very important part of the process in protecting the public interest and the integrity of the process. My personal opinion is that those services of reviewing the appraisal work are probably best performed by those outside government agencies, those who are in private practice, because they would be more likely perceived as independent and objective. The pages following, page 6, in brief, I've put some contact information, brief description in there of the Appraisal Institute, other appraisal organizations through the state. And also let me say briefly that in addition to being an MAI and having formed our task force, our local chapter's task force on Measure 37, I've worked with Kurt Mueller, our past president, who has set up a broad-based group called the Appraisal Coalition that involves all the professional organizations of appraisers in the state so that we can speak with one voice on these issues. So I'm here both representing my chapter and that group. Other important information at page 7, for example, is a little bit of information about the appraiser and licensing board of the ACLB. Mr. Bob Keith, the administrator of the ACLB, is here with us today, and he might be able to address some of the certification questions in greater detail than I can. And then pages 8 through 10, I've taken some excerpts from our Oregon administrative rules regarding the allowable scope of practice for appraisers who are general certified, residential certified, and residential licensed. And I'd be glad to answer any of your questions or any details you want to ask them.
Anybody have any questions of Mr. Larvin or Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you tell me the relationship of an MAI to general certified or state certified general appraiser or the other categories?
Certainly, yes, Chair Gerard and Representative Anderson. The MAI is a designation that is awarded by the Appraisal Institute, and it recognizes that the person who gets the designation has gone well beyond the state requirements in terms of education, experience, specialized property types, and including the writing of a comprehensive kind of a master's thesis, so to speak, on appraisal, as well as taking a comprehensive exam.
An MAI could be any one of these three, or all three.
No, an MAI would be a general certified appraiser. Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Representative Ackerman.
Yes, do you have an opinion as to whether the statement of a property owner on a Measure 37 application, which gives the owner's opinion value of his or her property, would be sufficient to constitute fair market value under Measure 37?
Chair,
standing alone, nothing else.
Chair Gerard and Representative Ackerman, I would think that, of course, as owners, we're all entitled to our opinion of value. Whether that constitutes a reflection of market value, I'd say in most cases not very likely, just because it takes a little bit more expertise to judge the value of a property, particularly when we're talking about vacant land.
Thank you.
Any further questions of Mr. Laney? As a former county commissioner, I remember how difficult it was to develop land. When you look at a piece of land and you're looking at the perspective of what's the best use, you're giving everything an approval? to reach that point of valuation? In other words, you're assuming that everything would be approved on that piece of land?
I think it could be a little too dangerous to assume too much. And we, as appraisers, try to emulate the kind of due diligence and investigation that a typical well-informed buyer in the market would do. So we will go down to City Hall,
talk to the city planners.
We'll talk to other experts as needed to gather the information about the subject and about the regulations in that area.
So let's say we can get water and sewer and everything we need, but let's say the fire department says you don't have enough, you're not going to have enough water pressure from that well. Is that going to scutter the whole appraisal if one area can't meet muster, so to speak?
I'd say in that case, and it's been typical where I would try to, particularly for a large tract of land, call for a pre-application conference so we could get all those issues out into the open. Typically, there's no hard and fast answer. It might revolve around some negotiation, for example, requiring that the houses are sprinklered or the addition of a cistern could help overcome a particular development problem. And, of course, that would come at a cost that would have ultimately come off the value of the land.
And one last question. What's the number of homes, the minimum number of homes that constitute a subdivision? And I know there's a minimum number in regards to water supply, et cetera.
Well, this may vary by jurisdiction. What I understand is that the term lot line adjustment, minor partition, is used by some jurisdictions for up to perhaps four lots, perhaps five lots. Beyond that, they might require you to go through the subdivision process, which is more likely to involve a public hearing.
Not seeing any other questions, Mr. Noby, thank you very much for coming today.
All right. Thank you very much, Chair Gerard and committee.
We shall close the informational meeting and open a public hearing on House Bill 2484. And we'll need the list of those who wish to speak. Committee members, just to update you a little bit, we have -3 amendments coming to this bill. We will not vote on this bill today. We will, in all probability, vote on Wednesday when the -3 amendments are presentable to this committee.
Mr. Chair? Any chance we can get them in time to digest them before the vote?
I think that would be
most appropriate.
I would appreciate it if that's possible.
We'll try and get them to you as soon as we can.
Thanks.
I'm trying to look down a list of those to speak. We have about 13 people. And I always like to take elected officials first, but I can't tell if there are any elected officials on here. So I'll just do my best. We also look for people who have a little more than 100 miles away, and there's no one in that regard. So why don't we have, I hope I'm pronouncing her, Phil Dixer?
Phil
Decker. Sorry, Phil, but you have a signature just like my doctor.
Well, it's often been said, sir, that lawyers are actually doctors who can't stand the sight of
them. Oh, I didn't say that. Jim Thompson and Jack Hoffman. I'll have all three of you come up if you're present. Jim Thompson and Jack Hoffman. Mr. Dixon, will you offer to go first? Mr. Decker?
Thank you, sir. Mr. Chairman and honorable members of the committee, my name is Phil Decker, D-E-C-K-E-R, and I reside in the Tigard area of Washington County, and it's a true honor to be able to testify before you here this afternoon. As indicated on the sign-in sheet, I am appearing on behalf of and in support of SB 2484 in the last version I saw. So, in a sense, I feel, as I'm sure many of us do, a bit handicapped, not what the bill actually says at this point, but proceeding on the assumption that it is still in its original condition, I would like to make just a few brief points. Number one, in context, and I use the Bear Mountain Tigard example as opposed to its particulars, presents issues which I think are very important to take a look at, less in the context of the details than the overall impact of approaching annexation in a single majority manner. By definition, where you have a superpower votes in one pile and a lesser pile of votes in the other, there is simply no way, as a practical matter, that the folks in the area to be annexed, even if it is 100% turnout most often, can possibly materially impact or affect the outcome of the issue before them, namely, shall we be annexed into whatever the adjacent city is. As a consequence, the vote of a person in the area sought to be annexed then has a diluted or fractional vote, as a practical matter, not a full vote. That raises some interesting legal issues, not to mention issues that go back to the concept of what voting is and what a vote is, both in our state and in our country. One of the vexing concepts at work here is that in a single majority environment, those within a jurisdiction, in this case, for example, the city of Tigard, are given the right, through the overpowering number of their votes, to vote on the outcome of property rights of those who are physically outside the jurisdiction of the particular city or district, which is a curious concept for which I can't really find any clear precedent in a voting context. Second, I look to see whether there's any historical precedent to the concept of diluted or fractional vote. Now, I don't pretend to be the world's best researcher by a long shot, but despite a fairly diligent search, the only precedent I found for diluted or fractional votes by a citizen in this country goes back to the concept of three-fifths of a person that was prevalent in this country prior to the enactment of the 13th Amendment back in the 1860s, if memory serves. In other words, where the person's presence in the polity is less than one. By definition, a vote in the area to be annexed is a vote of less than one if it is impossible as a practical matter to effectuate the outcome of the election. Third, what are the alternatives to a diluted or fractional vote? Again, for which I find no precedent. Well, we can have a diluted vote, which is some call a shotgun wedding, or we can have no vote. That is, where the people in the area to be annexed have no vote in the question of whether they should be annexed. Flip that logically. The people in the area to be annexed have a vote, yes or no, as to whether they want to be annexed. And the residents of the city that will receive the annexation have no vote. So we have a diluted vote, we have no vote, and no vote as three alternatives. The fourth alternative is, at least in my humble opinion, I would urge, consistent with the most basic, fundamental, clear-cut rights central to the way this democracy works, namely a fair vote. Only where the people in the area to be annexed and the people in the area to which the annexation is sought to occur, only when each of those voters has the ability to effect and determine the outcome can the concept of full vote be given full voice. Just a couple of quick comments. By the way, there's all kinds of what I've heard about, well, it's unfair for the cities and subsidizing and this and that and that sort of thing. I personally, I've looked at a number of those things. I don't pretend to be an expert. But at the same time, I see a lot of that as a red herring, as a practical matter, and a cause for delay, which is not uncommon when it comes to special local governments. That cuts both ways. As an example, I might cite on the proposition of, well, the city is always subsidizing the area to be annexed, et cetera, et cetera, it's unfair, unfair. There's a minor matter in the city of Tigard and the Bull Mountain area of some $800,000 that we just found out about, despite the unwillingness of the city to show us the books. A minor matter of $800,000, which the residents of Bull Mountain have through their property taxes paid and is being currently held by the city of Tigard for use for street improvements on Bull Mountain. Now, I'm not quite sure what the unfairness of that is, or what the fairness of that is, rather. I do note, however, that none of that $800,000, not penny one that we can find, has been spent for road improvements in the Bull Mountain area, even though it's been bought and paid for lastly. I'm happy to report that despite the result of the Bull Mountain entitled vote, and contrary to the dire predictions of all the city planners and city folk and what have you, and I say this with all due respect, when last I checked, walking into the building, the sky had not yet fallen. Thank you very much.
Any questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you, sir. As I indicated to you earlier, that we like to take elected officials first, and I have two state representatives that wish to speak, so I'll ask you to step down, if you will, and Representative Crummell to come forward, and then we have Representative Hunt also present. Gentlemen, I'm sorry for the delay, but...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, State Representative Jerry Cuomo, House District 26, which is Wilsonville and Southern Washington County. Mr. Chair, thank you. I will be very brief. I just wanted to the opportunity to kind of bring to your attention with regards to House Bill 2484. Being a one of the chief sponsors on this bill and not seeing any of the amendments, and just now seeing the dash ones for the first time and the dash threes that I understand, and I don't know where the dash twos might be. But just to let you know that from a real general sort of a perspective, anything that would water this bill down and delete or eliminate the double majority would be unacceptable to me. And I think that it should be unacceptable to this committee as well as the body as a whole. I think that what we're trying to accomplish here is fairness for the fairness for people being whose property is being annexed into cities, as well as for the annexing cities, from a standpoint of agreeing to take in additional territory. I think that just glancing over the dash one amendments, there are some concerns that I have relative to that because of in section two, the things that are being that appear to be taken out. But I haven't actually digested it all yet, but I also understand from the comments earlier that there's a dash three coming, which may be encompassing the dash ones.
As of this case,
and I will hold my powder on that, but I just did want to express to you, Mr. Chair, that anything that would water down the original intent of the bill from a standpoint of creating a double majority would be unacceptable. Thank you.
Well, just as a point of interest, Representative, the committee has not accepted any amendments at this point.
Okay. Thank you.
Any questions of Representative Crummell? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hunt.
Chair. For the record, State Representative Dave Hunt from Clackamas County. More than anything, just wanted to affirm this legislation, and despite a lot of media reports that have gotten generated around this, which have really made it out to be a Washington County issue, just really remind you, as many of you know, including yourself among them, Mr. Chair, that this really is a statewide issue. We have in Clackamas County almost 170,000 unincorporated residents. 170,000. Unincorporated residents, many of whom are represented by my colleagues, Representative Smith, Representative Sumner. I have about 45,000 of those unincorporated folks in my district. And these folks, as they look at issues around annexation, they don't have a voice. If I were a resident of a city, I would have elected my city council members to represent me in those decisions. As a resident of an unincorporated area, along with 45,000 other constituents, we don't have a localized government looking out specifically for our interests. We have county elected officials who are looking out for our interests at the county level, but this dual majority legislation would give us an actual voice in this process. And in some cases, we might vote yes, and in other cases, we might vote no, and they would really empower voters more than anything to give them a voice. So I commend this legislation to you in its original form, or very close thereto, and also thank you on behalf of the rest of our state, because this legislation will have a beneficial impact, not just in Washington County, but throughout Oregon.
Any questions of Representative Hunt? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
Jim Thompson.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the House Land Use Committee. My name is Jim Thompson, and I think I need to point something out. But I actually wear two hats in this matter, and if they don't coincide, we were dealing with the ramifications of the proposed measure. I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 2484, Chairperson of the Oregon Communities for Voice and Annexations, OCBA. My other role is that of the mayor of the city of Turner. And my colleagues from the LAE, at least for their staff, have announced their opposition to this legislation. Perhaps here, if I might stop for just a moment, I've been at the Capitol all day today on some other issues, and I was handed an email a few minutes ago that indicates there might be some kind of a compromise proposal that the League and OCBA and perhaps others have been looking at, and I'm not prepared to deal with that, so I'm going to go ahead with my testimony. If you want to share that with us, I would be happy and heck to hear that.
We may have some testimony following.
Fine, thank you, sir. I want to point out, if you're not already aware, that there are presently 30 cities in the state of Oregon that have voter-approved annexation requirements in their city charters. That number represents 12.5% of the total number of incorporated cities in the state. These 30 cities have nearly 500,000 citizens, and at least 8 of them have 20,000 or more living within their boundaries. In each case, the voters are giving themselves the right to determine if an annexation is appropriate. In doing so, it's obvious that these citizens believe they should be making final decisions on the question of whether to expand city boundaries rather than simply turning their responsibility over a handful of elected officials, people who are not, in most cases, functioning as full-time officials. And I here would like to mention that our city, Turner, is one of those cities, and when our citizens voted on amending our charter in 1998, the measure passed by almost 90%. Adoption of House Bill 2484 by this session will do nothing more than level the annexation playing field, contrary to arguments you will hear from those who are in opposition. I submit that a clear and concise reading of House Bill 2484 will totally support this argument. You will hear that many annexations are requested by property owners, and that is true. But why must their neighbors be pulled into a city if the majority of them are not interested? Voter-approved annexations require a majority of those voting must vote in the affirmative before an annexation can be approved. All this measure will do is create a double majority, with both sides then having the same right of decision. The voters in 30 cities believe it is the democratic thing to do by mandating the decision on annexations to a majority vote themselves. And why then is it not just as democratic to give the citizens currently on the outside the same option? closing my remarks, I'd like to remind you of what Abraham Lincoln said at Gettysburg in 1863. I wasn't there, but I read this. The government of the people, by the people, for the people shall not perish from the earth. And I believe that adoption of this proposal will follow that principle. I sent each of you a previous email, I believe, on February 8th in support of the bill, and I again testify in support, and I thank you very much for allowing me to appear.
Any questions for Mr. Thompson? Thank you,
thank
sir.
You, Mr.
I appreciate
Chairman.
You coming in. Mr. Hoffman.
No, this is fine. Representative Gerard, my name is Jack Hoffman. I am a member of the Lake Oswego City Council and have been an elected official for 6 years. I'm also chair of the Metro Policy Advisory Committee, which is the advisory committee that advises the Metro Council on metro regional land use issues. In fact, MPAC last week conducted a mini symposium on the issue of annexation in the regional area. And that was attended by approximately 100 people, and it was certainly the not consensus, but the sense of the group that this is not a problem with just Beaverton or Bull Mountain and Tigard, but rather it is certainly a regional issue, and of course it's a state issue. When I'm not on the Lake Oswego City Council, I am a partner with the Portland law firm of Dunn Kearney. My practice emphasizes land use, and ironically enough, I represent landowners whose property is being taken by condemnation. I provided a 2.5-page document, and I'd like to go through and just hit the highlights. House Bill 2484, of course, is amending ORS Chapter 195, which is Senate Bill 122. I have had the Senate Bill 122 hearings transcribed. I have those available if the committee would like to read them. It's clear as to what that legislative committee and that legislature was intending to do, and that was address long-range planning within the urban growth boundary. They recognize the importance of governmental units talking to each other. They recognize the importance of representational democracy, and that special districts have elected officials, counties have elected officials, fire districts have elected officials, and cities have elected officials, all voted on and elected by voters. So the fractional voting issue I don't buy. So, and apparently neither did they do buy that 12 years ago. Because in those discussions, at those hearings, it appeared to me in reading those transcripts that they were concerned about the governmental units dealing with each other, coordinating with each other, and providing infrastructure and urban services to the unincorporated areas within the urban growth boundary. We all recognize that the laissez-faire, leaving people alone, ignoring neighborhoods within the urban growth boundary was not good planning. We also recognize the issue of voting and the fact that you have a vote of the larger group, the larger community. And in that case, they said they recognized that was an issue, but then they turned that around and said, because of the representational aspect of the governmental units coordinating, that I think they believe, though it wasn't specified in the hearing transcripts, that they assumed that if someone in the unincorporated area had a concern, they would go to their county. And with all due respect to Representative Hunt, if the people in Clackamas County, because I represent Lake Oswego and Clackamas County, if they have a concern about Lake Oswego or about me, they can go to their Clackamas County commissioners. So,
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question? Thank you. I really would like to clarify what you said before. You say people vote, let's say, for a fire district.
I'm assuming that.
And so the commissioners or the councilors or whatever it is are their representative government, and that's for the people who are in the current fire district.
Correct.
Now, when you start talking about an annexation, you're saying that the people in the area to be annexed also voted for that fire, for those fire district councils?
Well, that's a good question, Representative Greenlee. That triggers a couple of comments. First of all, of course, Chapter Senate Bill 122 requires that you have governmental agreements, everybody agrees this is the plan, and then you put it to a vote. But at least with respect to Lake Oswego...
Everybody agrees. Excuse me, Mr. Allen. Are you talking about ORS 268? Is that the...
No, I'm talking about 195-215. That's what we're talking about, is Chapter 195 agreements.
In the metropolitan area, aren't they governed by
ORS 222 rather than 195?
ORS 268. I mean, there's that issue about whether ORS 268 trumps or modifies 195, so therefore it's a 222. But the concept's the same,
all right,
whether it's outside the metro jurisdiction or not. The concept is, and I'll just use like Oswego as an example, like Oswego started the Chapter 195 process in 2003. They went out to the community because of school district issues and school funding issues, because we wanted to make the school district boundary the same as the city boundary. That's not important. But we went out to, and my staff went out, to all the different district personnel and the district elected officials and talked to them about coming up with an annexation plan. And we negotiated with the fire district, negotiated with water districts, negotiated with Clackamas County, etc. And the reason we did that is because of our comprehensive plan. Lake Oswego's comprehensive plan isn't just for Lake Oswego. Is for everybody within our urban service boundary. And so within our urban service boundary, we have about 42,000 people. The people that are outside the city but within the urban service boundary is about 6,000. So our comprehensive plan, which has had input from neighbors outside the city limits, has been in place for 10, 15, 20 years. The last amendment was in 94. So based upon that comprehensive plan, which says that we are going to be the provider of urban services, that we are going to do island annexations, we went ahead in 2003 and started the process.
If I can follow the question, I'm not sure I heard the answer to the question. Let's talk about the 6,000 that live outside Lake Oswego.
Yes.
The input was for their elected through their elected representatives?
I am assuming so.
Who were their elected representatives? Wouldn't that be a discussion with Lake Oswego?
Well, there would be for the people living outside Lake Oswego within the urban service boundary, their elected officials would be the county, Clackamas County. I assume it's the water districts, and I assume it's the fire districts.
And if I can follow up. Is there something in 195 that says the county can trump the double majority vote?
I don't know. I don't know. And I'm not intimately familiar with every part of 195. I don't remember that as the county trumping, but I'd be surprised.
Well, the issue that was raised before, and the issue, if I may continue, that I'm trying to find out, you asserted everybody has elected representatives in the representative government. Turns out there are 160,000 people in Clackamas County, 190,000 people in Washington County inside urban growth boundaries and unincorporated areas,
but
that when you're talking about a city deciding who to annex, don't have an elected representative in that discussion. It is true the city can create a comprehensive plan.
Correct.
But the 190,000 people in Washington County and 160,000 people in Clackamas County don't have their elected representatives in an agreement, say, between Lake Oswego and Lake Oswego School District, or Lake Oswego and perhaps Fire District, if they're not in.
No, we have to enter into an annexation plan with Clackamas County. We have to make an agreement to take over the roads. And I assume that if the three Clackamas County commissioners thought it was a bad idea, they would say no to the annexation plan, or say the annexation plan will take place in 50 years.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Just quickly, so let me just tell you the Lake Oswego 2003 story. So unlike City of Tigard and
Bull Mountain, we didn't go to a vote.
Because what happened was in Lake Oswego is that we were getting resistance from the neighbors outside the city limits, who were telling us that they didn't want to pay taxes, they didn't think they were getting benefits, and they didn't want to vote in city elections. We are also getting polarization from the neighborhood associations inside the city limits. People who were saying, coming up to me and saying, why is it fair that those people who live just on the other side of Elm Street are paying less in taxes, less in benefits than the people that we're paying? And I had no answer for them, because there are people that are three blocks away from me that are in an island right across from Lake Oswego Country Club that is unincorporated Lake Oswego. The analysis we did, just quickly, is that for those residents that live outside Lake Oswego, inside the urban services boundary, they get a subsidy of about $500 a year per household, and that people who live inside Lake Oswego cost us about $80. And as an example, we've had approximately $50 million of open space, parks bonds, street bonds, and that's all paid by city residents. As another example, the city has a street maintenance fee. It costs me $7 every 2 months. It's on my water bill. And that you won't find out on any water bill of any of the people living outside the city. So those are the things that were brought up to us. I didn't, when the Oregon Communities for Voice Annexation talks about a hostile takeover, I have run for city council to take over jurisdiction, take over suburbs, and take over neighborhoods. That wasn't why I was elected. And it's not a city, it's not the unincorporated voters versus six or seven elected officials, because we just respond to community-wide perspectives and problems. That's why we're hired, and that's why we're elected, rather, we're not hired. Our job is to balance community-wide interests and listen to the neighborhood associations inside the city as well as the neighborhood associations outside the city. House Bill 2484 takes away a tool, and human nature being what it is that based upon all the hearings I've been to, both Washington County, I went to one with Charlie Cameron, same with Representative Greenlick, I've been to the Tiger and Bull Mountain hearings, I've been to my own Lake Oswego hearings. And at least my prediction of human behavior is that 90% of the time, the people are going to vote these annexations down. And if that is a pattern, if I'm correct, then their wish to be left alone will be the worst nightmare in terms of infrastructure and in terms of facilities. Because even in Lake Oswego, we're seeing the deterioration of infrastructure before roads and sewer. We have 6,000 people in the Lake Oswego community between the city limits and the urban services boundary who are on septic tanks. We have 6,000 people living and 5,000 people on septic tanks. We have roads that are 50 or 60 years old. We have, apparently, these big drains in these unincorporated roads that are essentially many brownfields that have to have DEQ permits. So we have a lot of problems. So 2484 is a recipe for creating, I think, the kind of urban environment that perhaps we're not very interested in doing that we would be very proud of.
Mr. Hoffman, what the heck is your county doing?
They are getting out.
If you have all these problems in your unincorporated areas, that's the responsibility of your county commissioners.
Clackamas County, like Washington County, are getting out of the urban services business, at least in our neck of the woods, in our neighborhoods.
Well,
they want to get out of the urban services business.
Well, if I may.
Representative.
The residents in urban unincorporated Washington County receive their water by the same water district the city of Beaverton residents receive. They receive their sewer from Clean Water Agency of the county. They receive their fire from the same fire district that the city of Beaverton people receive. They receive their same parks and recreation from the same district the city of Beaverton receives. I mean, it seems quite possible that an urban county like Clackamas County could react the same way an urban county like Washington County does, provide special service districts, very large, very efficient special service districts that serve, that don't notice when they cross the boundary. Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue will go to a house fire in Beaverton and unincorporated Washington County, collect taxes from both of them, and not know the difference. There are 400,000 people in unincorporated areas of the metropolitan, of the three-county area. That's, I think, is about as large as the largest city in the state right now. And they are receiving services, aren't they? Is that not feasible? Is the vision I just gave you not a feasible vision?
I think your vision is feasible if there are enough financial resources and if there is a mechanism for delivery of urban services to the unincorporated areas. And I suppose that's why, kind of closing, because there's people that also want to talk, is that it's a complicated issue that deals with island annexations, special districts, and it's something that deserves more attention, perhaps a task force or some sort of interim look at it between now and 2007. Because what may work for Cedar Mills may not work for Lake Oswego, which may not work for Klamath Falls, which may or may not work for Redmond. So it's a very complicated issue. Every neighborhood that even in Lake Oswego, all seven other neighborhoods that we were thinking about annexing are different. Each one has their own particular problems and challenges. So just in summary, that would be our recommendation, that we take it a little slower, a little bit more thoughtful, because it's extremely complex, the delivery of urban services within the urban growth boundary, and yet also respect people's right to vote and to have a say in their own future.
One final question,
Representative.
Taking slower, easier, thinking about it, you think the cities of the state would be willing to have a moratorium on annexation while we were taking it slow and thinking about it?
Do I think the cities of the state?
Yeah. I mean, let's say we go ahead. Okay, let's take our time. Let's take a couple of years. Do you think all the cities in the state would say, fine, we'll take a moratorium on annexations as of next Monday?
I think
while we take our time to think about it?
Thank you, Representative Lulick. I am not comfortable in representing all the 240 cities within the state of Oregon, but let me just give you a couple of thoughts. And I'll give you a kind of perspective so you kind of know where we're coming from. We stopped because we don't want to bring into our city people who are going to vote against bonds and against renewal, against bonds and against levies. It doesn't make sense to make people hate you. That's not why I got into local politics. And so I think that thoughtful, intense discussions is the way to go. So I think I answered your question.
Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hoffman, do you see any difference in, say, urgency between islands that are within the city limits and those areas outside city limits in the UGB or USB that are to be annexed?
Thank you, Representative Anderson. I think that's a very important question. And I do very much distinguish between the islands and the ones that are on the fringes. The ones that are the 2 acres, 3 acres, 4 acres, and I'm not making any comments. I will not make any comments on Beaverton's issue. I just address Lake Oswego's issue. We have 8, 10, 15-acre islands right in the middle of downtown Lake Oswego, or essentially right in the heart of Lake Oswego. I think that would be appropriate for just letting the cities annex them without a vote, just the statute that we have now. I would be reluctant to and would oppose making that part of the moratorium process, because there's special problems there. I mean, it doesn't make sense for somebody, for Mrs. Smith here and Mr. Jones there, they're just next to each other, to have different obligations and different rights and responsibilities. That's not really fair to anybody. And so I think that can be left alone. But, you know, I don't think that should be off the table for between 05 and 07. I think the whole thing should be discussed. Island annexations, fringe annexations, etc. But I certainly would be opposed to changing the island annexations, because especially like Oswego, we have that problem that we're trying to address. We're trying to clean it up. The country club came in about 4 years ago. We'd like to bring in the neighborhood right across the street.
Representative Ackerman.
Yes, if I followed your testimony earlier, you asserted that city residents would pay more in property taxes than county residents that are within the urban growth boundary. If that's true, isn't it because the city residents are still paying county real property taxes for services they no longer need or services that are no longer being provided? Right.
Thank you, Representative Ackerman. That is an issue because, as we all read, there's that urban subsidy. Are city residents paying both the city taxes and the urban tax, city taxes and county taxes, and therefore is that urban subsidy? And that's something that I don't know if it is or it does or does not exist, but I know that Washington County is going to figure it out in the next year and a half or two. But in terms of, I don't mean to say that city residents are paying more in taxes than county residents. Typically, they're pretty close to each other, because a county resident that is within our urban services boundary will pay for enhanced sheriff, they'll pay for the water, they'll pay for fire, they'll pay for all the things. What they're not paying, but taking advantage of or using, and I don't want to get into that debate because it gets really people polarized, and so I don't want to focus on it, but just like Oswego, for example, is the issue of bonds and street maintenance fees that one side pays, Mrs. Smith pays, and Mr. Jones does not.
I just want to follow up. This may be a little beyond the scope of your testimony here, but it just occurred to me, and I make this assertion, I think if you say, if it's, see if you think it's correct. It appears in land use planning that the planners have decided that the city should be the logical extenders of urban services. But many of the areas, including the area I live in, are fully urbanized, unincorporated, but within the urban growth boundary. What more urbanization would we need by annexation? Isn't it moot? Isn't annexation moot under those circumstances? Isn't that land use goal moot under these circumstances?
It depends, Representative Ackerman, on terms of if all the services are being provided and if that's what the regional vision is, if that's what the county's vision is, but under those circumstances, perhaps. It may be that one size doesn't fit all. The conventional wisdom 11 years ago was that cities were the logical providers of urban services. I think most people are still believing that. Although with Measure 47 and Measure 50, we're starting to see some fraying at the edges, with, especially with like Gresham and Oregon City. But I can't answer your specific question with your specific area, because it depends upon infrastructure, the delivery of infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And as elected officials, we have to look beyond the next mortgage. Unfortunately, our role is to not look at the next mortgage payment or the next property taxes due, but about 10, 15, 20 years. And that's sometimes where we get this disconnect between the people who are very legitimately concerned about a right to vote and about the property taxes. There's this conflict, I think, 2 years, take a run at it.
We do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying it's more
inclusive, right, that all elected officials take the long view.
Bill, thank you very much for coming in. We appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, while the next panel's coming up.
We'll bring forward Linda Ludwig, Andy Parks, Burton Reist, and Doug Riggs.
While they're coming forward, this issue of whether people inside the county pay, people inside the city subsidize the people outside the city, and the county tax is an interesting one in that Washington County, I think a group of counties passed out this big sheet of county services, and there were about 25 county services on that, only three of which were not used by the people in the city. It would be very interesting if our county group somewhere along the line could really discuss the analysis of it. You know, it was all the court services, the juvenile justice, the aging, the health, public health. Almost all of the services were provided both for the county and the city people. But if there is some good analysis on whether folks outside of cities but within counties are not paying their fair share, it is something we ought to look at. And I think we all agree all folks should be paying their fair share.
And also tell that works the other way around. In Klamath Falls, there is no city jail, only a county jail.
And in Beaverton.
And that's paid for by county residents and not city residents. Although city residents pay for the police force, but not the county sheriffs.
Yes.
Interesting. And it does open up that question. You're right, Representative. Good afternoon, panel.
Mr. Chair, just before you get off that point, though, every property in the state is within a county. And so every property in the state pays county property taxes.
Right.
But they don't all pay for city services. So even the properties within the city of Klamath Falls, for example, pay the county property tax.
Good.
Mm-hmm. Well, most of the function of counties, as I say, just numerically, I think it was 22 out of 25, were not duplicated inside the city. They were services that the county provides for.
Representative has raised a good point that we ought to really get a dispassionate, objective analysis of the question of contributing to fair share of services. And I think that's a very good idea.
Panel, who would like to start off? Everyone's pointing a finger at Linda, so good afternoon, Ms. Lundberg.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Actually, I'd like to introduce Mr. Andy Parks here from Oberlin Central Oregon.
Chair Gerard, Vice Chair Anderson, and Vice Chair Greenlink, Members of the committee, my name is Andy Parks. I am the president and CEO of Gelt Oregon, a local government consulting firm, and I am testifying in opposition to House Bill 2484 prior to any amendments that you may or may not consider. I'd like to thank the committee and the League of Oregon Cities for their invitation to share my insights with you on this subject. I've lived in Oregon since I was 10 years old, graduated from Henley High School in Klamath Falls, and earned my business degree from U of O. I moved to Bend shortly after graduating from U of O, and I've worked there 13 years in local government and various finance and management positions, and I'm also a CPA. I'd like to present a perspective on annexation that may not have been considered. I've come to this perspective after observing and being involved with annexation from several viewpoints, including that as an annexed property owner. Perspective is that the ultimate city boundary is the urban growth boundary. When UGBs are created, they are done so through an extensive public process, and the known eventuality of all that live within the UGB is that that property within the UGB will one day be the city. The single vote method provides an alternative to efficiently and effectively annex property within the urban growth boundary. Annexation ensures fair and equitable taxation and the tools to meet infrastructure needs and to provide desired police and other community services as they are mandated by state law. Since the state has directed cities to be the urban service provider, has set forth requirements and limitations on how to accomplish this, and to date there is no evidence this method has been abused or has not been effective where implemented, why remove this tool from local officials' tool chest? Oregon's communities have a variety of issues to deal with, including but not limited to winning the war on meth and the related crime, responding timely to life-threatening events, improving transportation systems and other infrastructure, and planning the community's future. To most effectively and efficiently deal with these issues, particularly fast-growing communities, each of Oregon's communities need the ability to be a community. That is, the ability to annex urbanized areas that were planned to be annexed. Professionally, I perform analysis to determine the financial and service delivery implications of annexations from single properties to areas of common interest within various cities. I have determined the implications of the city and individual property owners, and I was one of the City of Bend's senior appointed officials that, at the direction of several different elected city councils over nearly a decade, evaluated and implemented an annexation strategy to unite Bend into one community. Bend became one community when voters in the entire Bend UGB, utilizing 97 legislation authorizing urban service provider annexations with a single vote, passed annexation by a more than 6-4 margin. As a city administrator for Madras, I advise the city council not to pursue an urban service provider annexation, but to pursue a consent annexation of its industrial park. The community needed to establish credibility with residents and others before it could even consider a single vote annexation. The mayor and council succeeded in their effort to annex that industrial park. And as a consultant, I perform financial analysis and operational analysis and draft an annexation plan to meet city requirements to allow a single vote in Redmond. The Redmond vote occurred in 2004, again with the passage by more than 6-4 margin. And currently I'm assisting another community with an evaluation of annexation. I mentioned I've been on the other side of an issue when our property was annexed to the City of Bend through the consent annexation process.
Representative Green.
On those 6-4 margins, what proportion of the total voters were within the city versus in the area to be annexed?
Representative Green, the number of folks, to best of my recollection, in the Redmond annexation was approximately 10%. In the Bend annexation, it was approximately 30%. And in the other example that I'm not as familiar with, but certainly them happen to mention it later, for the Bend Metro Parks and Rec District, which
is a very small percentage. And do you have any sense of how the people in that area voted? I mean, for example, in Bull Mountain, it was 90-10 against in the annexed area and overwhelmingly for in the city itself.
Right, and I can specifically speak to the Bend example. I believe there was approximately 1/3 of the people in the unincorporated area of the UGB that ultimately voted for the annexation, and approximately 2/3 within the city boundary, existing city boundary at that time, they voted for. in all my experience assisting local governments with this very complicated and controversial issue, and someone that was annexed had not witnessed one instance where a local government or local government official was looking to take advantage or realize a gain for the city or personally at the taxpayer's expense. What I have witnessed is local government officials seeking to determine how the local government could best meet the desires of its community, given the limitations and regulations imposed on it by the state and federal legislation. Some of you may be wondering how it came to be that practically every city in this state has a significant number of residents living in unincorporated areas just outside their city limits and within the UGBs. During the past 20 to 30 years, Oregon cities have been mandated by the state, since the passage of the state's first comprehensive land use laws, to be the urban service provider. Urban services include water, sewer, et cetera, and you're familiar with those. And prior to the passage of Measure 50, Oregon's property tax system provided a tax base method that did not provide additional property tax revenue for new construction. At that time, land use policies and the revenue policies in this state were disconnected. From a financial perspective, the former tax-based system encouraged cities to allow development to occur outside city limits with county approval and limited city oversight prior to consideration of annexation by the city. This strategy was used to allow the improvement value to be added to the city tax base upon annexation. But what often happened is that counties approved urban-level developments within UGBs with private water systems and septic drain fields without city approval. And when these systems began to fail, residents and counties looked to cities to solve the problem. However, often these systems did not fail at the same time, and without the cooperation of residents and other local governments, including the city, annexation often did not occur because a majority of residents in those limited areas did not want to annex. So other patchwork solutions were found, and the system failure continued and continues to this day. Did state and local governments make the right strategy call by allowing, even encouraging, through public policy, urban development outside existing city limits? Maybe, but given the rules at the time, ultimately collective decisions to not expand city boundaries to meet an increasing population and county governments' willingness to fill the vacuum has left many Oregon communities with a division within the community that there are no easy solutions or answers for. Going forward, it makes sense that local government should be given a little bit of latitude to help correct a situation that was to a large degree created by state land use and tax policy. The little bit of latitude is the current urban service provider annexation method for those communities that ultimately choose to use it. When I look at the maps that are before you, I see maps of Redmond and Bend. From the distance, these maps appear to be any one of several different communities in the state of Oregon. The map shows the current community boundary and the future expanded community boundary, but ultimately the map is of one community just the same. When the future boundaries are to be implemented, it should be a decision that the entire community makes with one vote, not a double majority of those that are in, those that are out, but one vote. In order to make the one vote decision, the law requires a considerable amount of analysis, evaluation, public discussion, and debate, and ultimately a plan that must be written and adopted. There must be intergovernmental agreements in place with all providers of urban services within the larger community. There is representation for current city residents and future city residents in this process. This process takes considerable time and effort and is done in public. In the cases of Bend and Redmond, it took several years and several different city councils to ultimately get to the one vote. And each community in Oregon, for a variety of reasons, can choose not to pursue the one vote annexation option, as has been the case with all but the two urban cities I've mentioned and the Parks District during the past 6 years. The 97 legislature recognized the barriers the previous land use, property tax system, and annexation rules placed on local government leaders. They understood that prior to the urban service provider annexation legislation, annexation that was intended and planned to occur did not. We have big issues to deal with in Oregon, including making our communities vital. And since the state has directed cities to be the urban services provider and has set forth requirements and limitations on how to accomplish the one-vote annexation, and it has worked as intended in the instances that I've noted, I recommend a no vote on HB 2484. Mr. Chair Gerard Vice Chair Anderson, Vice Chair Heinrich, members of the committee, I thank you again for the time to address the committee and be glad to respond to any questions you may have.
Andy, I got a couple of them for you. If I'm just driving down the road and I stop at a gas station to use the bathroom, they don't charge me for it. But somebody's paying for it. Isn't that the same thing you're talking about on urban service districts? With parks, anything else? I mean, the parks are there for everybody, whether they're city residents or not. Although I know some city parks and recreation departments that have restricted their programs to city residences only. But isn't that basically the way we, society?
Chair Gerard, just thank you for the question. I think that's maybe, you know, look at another way. If there wasn't somebody paying to have that gas station there, there would not be a gas station. If there was not somebody ultimately paying to have the parks there, there would not be a park. Who should ultimately pay to have that park there, I think, is a community-wide decision, not necessarily those that choose to opt out of paying for those infrastructure improvements on a community-wide basis.
But I may be shopping at a local grocery store, and that's why I came into the city, to allow my children to play in the park, you see. So the city benefits from the people coming into the city to spend the money and utilize the park at the same time. Well, they're not paying for the park, but they are paying in a lot of cities special taxes that are aimed specifically at that type of thing. Ashland has its restaurant tax, right? You want to eat out in Ashland, you're going to pay an extra tax to do it. Isn't that similar to what we... I can't see that difference yet, okay?
Chair Gerard, I think it would be in the neighborhood of a frequency of utilization. If you're right across the street in an urbanized environment and you are outside the Parks District and the citizen that lives right across the street is in the Parks District and you're ultimately using the park on the same basis, certainly it's inherently unfair that the resident that is inside the district paying the taxes and the resident across the street isn't paying the taxes but getting equal benefit from that. And I think those are community decisions, again, made in a very public process to ultimately decide who's in, who's out, and where those boundaries are to be. This is not a suggestion that the boundary, you know, if you look back at the development of an urban growth boundary process, most property owners are fighting to be included in the urban growth boundary. And subsequently, after development, the subsequent owners to the property are fighting not to get annexed into the city, even though that was the intent all along. Somewhere along the line, policymakers have to understand what it is they're trying to accomplish. If they don't want anybody ultimately to pay for anything, then ultimately all the stuff will go away, because it does cost somebody something, and the services without that funding will ultimately disappear.
I got one more for you that's probably a little more controversial than that. If you have a piece of land within the urban growth boundary and that land is rezoned, dramatically increasing that land's value, is it fair to hold the increase to under the 3% mandated by Measure 5?
Chair, that gets a little bit beyond the scope of, I guess, where I was prepared to discuss. I can suggest to you that I don't see why it would not go above the 3%. I can't think of a good argument as to why it would not be allowed to be valued at its highest and best use once that subdivision took place.
Well, that's what we heard the appraiser say a couple of moments ago, that land should be appraised on its highest and best use. Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Reese? Oh, Mr. Reese is going to go next.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Doug Riggs here on behalf of the Central Oregon Cities Organization, which is Redmond, Ben, Manor, Sisters, Metolius, Frydenville, Culver, and Maupin. I'm going to be brief. I just wanted to throw in 2 points, which I've not heard yet raised, at least not to my satisfaction, so I just want to make these 2 points. The first is that over the last couple of sessions, we've talked an awful lot about the need for economic development and the need to bring jobs and businesses into the state. And there's another bill that the committee is discussing industrial and commercial elements outside of the UGB, which would allow development to take place above the 3,500 square foot threshold in areas already zoned industrial and commercial by the counties. But if you look at Jefferson County as an example, of the 80 acres that are available, only about 13 of those acres are really beyond a 3-mile buffer beyond the UGB. So I'm extrapolating, but that's probably the case in other counties. So my point is that that bill alone is not going to address the industrial and commercial needs of the state. And so I guess my point would be that if we are trying to provide an opportunity for businesses to come into the state and grow, and those businesses will have employees, and those employees need places to live, the only way that we can do that in any sort of a common sense fashion is to allow development to take place within UGBs, and that requires annexation tools. Now, to be entirely honest, you're all right and correct when you point out that when you have these elections, many of the times you see what happened in Bend, which is only a third of the people in that area south of town actually voted for annexation. But that was property that needed to come into town to be developed, to provide houses for the new people who are moving into town as part of a state policy which has encouraged a 20-year supply of land and growth and encouraged development to take place within UGBs. Now, some counties may not be providing the scope of services that are necessary. Other counties want property to be annexed. And that was my second point. In almost every single case that I'm aware of, if Jefferson County or Kirk County or Deschutes County goes to annex a piece of property, that has to be done within the context of a comprehensive plan and a process in which the county is involved. And at any point in that process, those county commissioners who represent the people in that non-annex land have the opportunity to object and stop the process. Now, I may be wrong in the metropolitan area, but at least in Jefferson, Deschutes, and Cook counties, we have to get the approval and the sign-off and cooperation of our county commissioners. And so those people who are in the county land do have representation. They may not, 100% of them may not like the outcome at the end of the process, but they have the opportunity to go lobby their county commissioners and oppose the process. In Washington County, I think what has happened is the county commissioner has gone along with the idea that they want to give up large portions of the county. So the people in those unannexed territories at this point aren't happy with the county commissioners. But they are represented by people who they elect, who have the veto authority over the annexation of Beaverton or Madras or Redmond. So those are the 2 points that I wanted to make. I know you've got a tough task in front of you, but we're hopeful to be able to play an informational role if you need someone to be able to answer any questions.
Questions of Mr. Riggs?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, you're a kind of rational person. We've talked for a long time. I'm hearing a lot of this sort of left-wing talk about how things need to happen in order to be efficient. And one of the things about democracy is we're always balancing efficiency and the sort of messy process of democracy. If you imagine a hypothetical county, say somewhere, with a couple hundred thousand people that didn't want to be annexed to make it more efficient for city officials, how do you come down on that combination of, on that balance between the efficiency as sort of Mussolini tried to develop in Italy and the democracy that we struggle with in the United States?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlick, I've actually thought about it quite a bit in the last couple of weeks, and I guess the analogy that I would draw is if I'm a resident of Burns and I decide that I want to vote, as an example, for Kevin Mannix as governor, but the rest of the citizens of the state outvote me and they vote for Ted Kulongoski for governor, I don't feel like I'm represented. But it's one state, and we've decided, at least from that perspective, to make a decision based on everybody's vote in the entire state. And
let's say.
Can you hear the answer first, and then you can follow up, please?
You were right.
No.
please come.
Well, I was just going to say that I really view this system as a complete community type of activity. I think Andy mentioned earlier that, you know, what we're trying to do is create common sense boundaries for providing common sense communal services that everybody in a certain area wants to be provided. Sewer, water, parks, etc. And I guess my analogy was meant to say that Oregon is kind of a similar boundary. I mean, we're all in the same state, and it's a republic and not necessarily one for one democracy in a lot of cases.
Representative.
I was going to suggest that the analogy of everybody getting to vote for the governor and the winner wins and the loser loses isn't the same as saying, well, let's say 60% of the people will have the election for governor because that's more efficient, but the other 40% of the people won't vote for governor. Now, that's much more analogous to the situation we're talking about here, and that's what I was asking about, the balance between efficiency and democracy. If we came up with a more efficient electoral system, I'm on that elections committee, maybe we can try that where only 60% of the people or 70% of the people voted for governor, but 30% of the people didn't. Would you still have the same Kevin Mannix winning, losing argument?
No, Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlink, I guess what I'd argue is that everyone gets to vote. Not everybody's happy with the results of the election. This previous election might be a good case in point. I mean, if you look around the state, the blue versus the red states, you don't have an awful lot of people in certain states who are unhappy with the result. But everyone got the opportunity to vote. Now, I guess I'd go back to my fallback point, which is that every person who is potentially going to be annexed has an elected official or elected officials who could veto that annexation at any one point, and that would be the county commissioners. So if the county commissioner of Washington County decided that what Beaverton was trying to do was inappropriate, those people could go to their elected representative and say, we don't like this annexation, you are my elected county representative, we want you to oppose it. And I've heard several times suggest in the last few days that these people have no voice, and I want to argue they do have a voice. They can be outvoted if the annexation gets on the ballot, or if it's done in another manner, but neither of those can happen unless the county commission in the area consents to it, and that's state law. So I'm not sure I'm answering your question.
No, you did answer it. Thank you.
Any other questions? Mr. Riggs. Mr. Riggs.
Chair Gerard, members of the committee, I'm Burton Reist. I'm here today on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. I have to say this is, in one sense, this is almost a dream come true. Special districts were created as an association some 30 years ago to fight annexations by cities. And the organization revolved around that issue because districts felt they were being annexed. And there were changes proposed in the Oregon legislature to allow annexation by resolution of cities without remonstrance or without a vote of the people, and that's why we were created as an association 30 years ago, and that was why I was hired 30 years ago, which I'm forever indebted to all of you for. But
aren't you sitting with the wrong group?
Well, in some ways I am, and in some ways I'm not, and that's what I'd like to explain to the committee with your indulgence. Special districts' position is and has been and always will be that we believe the area to be annexed, that is the people who are going to pay a different tax rate, if people are going to pay different taxes as a result of an annexation, that those people in some form should have the way to either accept or reject that. And I say some form because annexation is very complicated, and while voting is one way for people to approve being annexed to whether it's a special district or a city, that's only one way. There are petitions, there are different, there's 13 different ways to annex people in Oregon. And our position is if your tax rate is going to change, you have some rights there, however you exercise them. But we also have another concern, and that is in the discussions in this bill, and it's about the principle of both parties voting on an annexation, where in 195 you have a situation where the whole area votes, and the proposal in the bill is for both the city and the district, or district, city and the area to be annexed to vote. And I'd like to raise to the committee some concerns that we have with that, because that's substantially different than giving just the people who are going to be taxed a right to a vote. In fact, this legislative body, including some of you good folks, just last session approved a bill that we introduced on behalf of Tuolumne Valley Fire and Rescue, which is in Washington County and serves 13 cities. And the issue there was the current law required when a district annexed a city, you had to have a vote in both the district and the city to accomplish it. And we pointed out to you that if that was the case, where you had very large districts like TVFNR, basically it's a moratorium against annexations, even when people want it. And the case was West Lynn. The city of West Lynn wanted to be annexed by TVFNR, but it was some 16 or 17,000 voters, and yet the district would have had to pay some $70,000 or $80,000 in election fees, would have had to convince some 400,000 people in three counties that they should approve that annexation to those 15,000 people, even when the existing voters' tax rate for fire service would not change. So our first concern here is that in the discussion about ORS 195 annexations, I would urge the committee to try to think through the issue of this double vote requirement. Further, the other thing I would urge the committee not to forget, notwithstanding the controversy here, and believe me, I'm well aware of it, when 12 Hills Park and Rec District wanted to discuss having a single vote ORS 195 annexation, I was invited to come and explain ORS 195, which I participated in the drafting in, and after getting beaten up by 400 people for 6 hours, I understand the issue only too well. But I would remind the committee that this is a unique kind of annexations. To the best of my knowledge, it's been discussed and not gone ahead in three areas, and it's been passed in three areas since 1993. This is not the typical annexation. The typical annexation is usually where a small parcel, small area, wants to get services, and it's quite often an economic development issue. It's quite often an area that needs services to build a factory, needs services to do a development, or whatever it is that's important to the economy of this state. And if we begin going down the path of double majority annexations, as some speakers have suggested today, you need to be prepared to understand what that means. That could be a significant impediment in the annexation that are currently carried out in Oregon, either by petition or a vote of just the area to be annexed. If jurisdictions, whether they be a district or a city, are required to have city or district-wide annexations to do these small parcels, you're going to see those cities and districts probably saying to the applicant, you're going to have to pay the cost of that election. And that might be prohibitive to annex that single parcel. So I just want to give you that thought. The other thing is we have found that where you do have city or district approval and the area to be annexed approved, there's great undervotes. And I've been trying to get the data for you. I will get it before we're through with this process. But I've been advised that the undervote is pretty terrific within those jurisdictions. In other words, this is not an issue that elicits a great deal of concern. Now, if certain cities want to have citywide votes, they can do that through their charter process. That's their business. Business would encourage them. Don't expect the legislature to preempt that. But to require it of everyone else, I think you should think twice. Now, I realize the bill before you today is only about ORS 195, but you're going to have lots of annexation bills. And I didn't want the committee to think that the double majority vote answers all the issues of democracy and peace and freedom and everything else that we're confronted with. We do have economic development issues. The other thing I'd like to is just very quickly talk to you about how did we get ORS 195. Back in the late, I think it was 89 session, when the land use program had never been tested, because ever since it had been passed, we'd been in a perpetual recession in the state, and there really wasn't a lot of growth. The legislature in the late 80s, as growth began to pick up at that time, got very concerned about, were we meeting the needs of development? Were we, you sound familiar, were we going to have enough, would there be enough land for industry, land for development, land for housing, whatever we need? so that Oregon's growth wasn't stifled by the land use program. This body approved $250,000 to hire a consultant, series of consultants actually, to look at that issue and say, what is it about Oregon's land use planning or our laws that are inhibiting economic development? They came up with a report, and they listed some 30 things that needed attention. Then Governor Barbara Roberts, along with LCDC, appointed some 16 work groups to work on various aspects of this program. One of the work groups dealt on one of the issues that was determined to be the most, one of the most significant, and that was, and it's an issue that's pretty much gone away, that we've forgotten about, and that is, in the late 80s, early 90s, there were legendary fistfights between special districts and cities over who was going to provide services in a particular area. Developers, the hospital case I remember, would come, they would go down to the county and say, we need to get services. You'd have the city objecting. Or if the city tried to annex a parcel to develop it, the special district would be running out, literally opposing, remonstrating, getting it on the ballot, literally being the center of opposition to these annexations. So we wound up in a situation where developers were being thwarted by fistfighting by local government. And we all agreed, cities and districts and counties, that that was unseemly and stupid on behalf of the people of Oregon. So the work group was created to deal with it, which I served on, and the work group created ORS 195. I would encourage the committee to look at all of ORS 195. ORS 195 does not ordain that cities are the sole provider of urban services. In fact, that doesn't exist anywhere in the statute. What it does say, however, is that cities and counties and districts should objectively sit down and look at issues such as who can provide costs more efficiently or products more efficiently, who can provide services to the land, who can do what in the best interest of the public, and then requires making decisions about who will serve what. And this process was incorporated into LCDC. It's now a work requirement through periodic review and has been in the last 15 years and has been very successful. How you got the 195 annexation piece of this was there was a decision by the legislature that if the cities, counties, and districts all sign agreements, all sign off on who's going to serve what territory, then the single vote could be used by a district or a city to implement that annexation plan after everybody had signed off on it. So I'd also like to commend to you that in this bill, you actually make it harder to do ORS 195 annexations than if you don't do urban service agreements in the first place. And that's another reason I'm concerned about the requirement for the vote in the existing territory and the vote in the area to be annexed. Because you, in essence, would say, if you go out and do all these urban service agreements, if you end the fist fight, if you decide who's going to provide which service, well, then we're going to go make you have this expensive vote in the city or the district and in the area to be annexed. But if you just don't do the agreements, you can just do the annexation anyway through a petition or just the area to be voted on. Bottom line, and I'll shut up here, the bottom line in all of this is this is why we special districts are supportive of having a very specific work, interim group assigned to deal with this annexation process. We have 13 ways to annex. I've been doing this my entire professional life dealing with annexation, and I'm not sure I could explain them all to you. How does a citizen work their way through this process? How does a city or a district or a county plan to provide services if they don't know? And I think this whole issue begs for a very studious process. I know the chair, Representative Greenlick, and others want to do some immediate things. That's fine. But I would certainly urge whatever you do, tie it to an opportunity for us to sort this out, and maybe we can do something good, not just change the edges, but maybe we can create an annexation process we can all understand makes sense for the voters and the people who are to be annexed, makes sense for the annexing agency, and doesn't hurt economic development in this county or in this state. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any questions of Mr. Reese? I got one for you, Bert. 195 does not indicate, or just 222, a minimum or maximum parcel size in regards to consented annexation. Is that something we need? And what would you recommend that size be?
I think what we did, this through a, you're talking about in the, whether a vote would be required in the area to be annexed or in the annexing territory. In,
I'm really talking about an island annexation, a small area of a city. Again, it is not in the city, but is getting all the city services. That is, the city wants to have the property, but the property owner is maybe one or two people and doesn't want to be because they're getting a free ride. What's the minimum or maximum size of that piece of land that should maybe qualify for a annexation without a vote?
Mr. Chair, I think there's two ways to, speaking specifically about island annexations, I think there's two ways to approach it. Number one, you have two choices. One, you could set a certain size to the require the vote. The other way to do it would be to set up a remonstrance procedure. Quite often we find that in some island annexations, it might be only one or two or three property owners who are really that concerned about the island, and perhaps the others would like to be annexed to get whatever the service is. If you had a remonstrance procedure, something that, you know, X number, the Boundary Commission statutes used to have 10% of the area affected. If they sign a petition, you can force, maybe it was 10% or 100 voters, whichever is the least, then you can get that petition, which is not difficult to do, and then you can force an election in that area. That's one alternative for you that lets the residents there a little bit of self-determination. Then if the majority of the residents want to be annexed, then you don't have to go through the, regardless of the size of the island, you don't have to go through the exercise of having an election if the majority clearly want it. As terms of picking a size, Mr. Chair, I'm reluctant. I mean, that'd be something we could certainly talk about. We could certainly look at a little history there, perhaps, but then I don't have a number or an acreage or a number of properties right off the top of my head.
But it was interesting that he used number of people rather than size of the parcel. It's another approach.
Yeah, the I think you might find the number of people or voters in the area might be better in terms of a potential court appeal, because we used to have the triple majority in annexations where it was the majority of the property owners, majority of the assessed value, and the majority of the properties, I guess. And the courts overturned that because you left out renters. You left out voters or people who are renters. So the one thing about the petition system or the remonstrance system is you don't get into that issue of property owners versus parcel sizes or that kind of issue, somebody taking you to the Supreme Court saying you left out this apartment house. They didn't get represented adequately because there were 50 people there, but it was only one property.
So you'd be happy if there was just a single vote, and you'd be okay with if it were just the area to be annexed?
That is our position, is in notwithstanding the other opportunities, petitioning and the other ways you can annex, you know, assuming all those stay in place and can be used, that's our position, is that it's not necessary to have 400,000 people vote to approve a 5,000 person annexation, and it's not advantageous if you are interested in any economic development or growth in your area.
Cannot an annexation affect the people who are already in the city as far as their tax rates are concerned?
Well, that was a significant issue before Measure 50. Now that we have a flat tax rate, and I'll go back using TDF&R as an example in this West Lynn annexation and the bill you passed last session, that's what we, the evidence we presented is TDF&R's tax rate, the amount those people will pay for fire service in the existing 13 cities and the unincorporated areas of Washington and Clackamas County will not change when they annex West Lynn. The people of West Lynn where I live, did get a tax increase of $1.69 a thousand, and we voted, 80% of us voted yes to pay an additional $1.69 in taxes to get TVF in our service. I think that's democracy in action. For us, those of us in West Lynn who wanted that fire service, to say to us that we had to organize a campaign effort to convince 400,000 other people in two other counties that they should vote yes to let us annex and tax ourselves didn't seem to be particularly protecting anybody's right. And you talk about a bifurcated vote, or you talk about taking vote or voting rights away from somebody, that's how to do it, to make me and West Lynn have to get 400,000 votes just to pay more taxes. Is illogical.
Thank you. Panel, thank you.
I have a follow-up.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Because now I'm really confused.
Nope, sorry.
So, did I just hear you say it's okay for 5,000 people to decide something maybe against the will of 400,000 people?
No, Chair Garrard, representing Nolan, there were two parts of the bill that we turned in, speaking specifically about that bill. One is, remember, it was only the people who were going to pay higher taxes, okay, that had the right to vote. And we also, in that bill, provided a provision for a remonstrance. If those 400,000 people felt aggrieved somehow by the annexation, there was a provision in the bill for a remonstrance where they could put it on the ballot. I think that's fair to everyone, and I think you need, after Measure 50, I think you have to remember tax rates are not going to change because you annex.
Follow up. So if 399,000 of those people didn't want this, the onus is on them to have to go out and collect signatures and create a ballot measure. I'm just having a hard time with the wrapping ourselves in the flag about democracy and peace and justice and the American way. And I'm hearing you say that the interests of those 400,000 people get outweighed by the interests of the 5,000, or at least that they have to make an extra effort to assert their interests. And I'd suggest that the answer isn't just about taxes, because annexations are not just about taxes. They're about how we build communities.
Chair Garrard, representing Nolan, if you'll forgive me, since you brought up the American flag and wrapping ourselves in it, to our point of view, the issue is taxation without representation. All right, the people in that area, in the existing city or the existing fire district, you keep using that example, they do have representation. They elect five directors directly who set policy or subject to election. I'm sure those 399,000 people, if they were anguished over the annexation of the 15,000 of us in West Lynn, they do have representation. They've got direct elected officials to deal with it. The 15,000 of us in West Lynn, okay, we're not part of that fire district. And if we didn't have a right to a vote before we were annexed, then we would be annexed without representation. So I think the idea is taxation without representation. You get it if you're in the annexing jurisdiction. You've got elected officials who vote on this, who held hearings, and who are subject to recall and re-election and all of those issues.
One last final follow-up then.
Follow.
So what I'm hearing from all of this is that you're saying that representative government is adequate for making certain decisions, but it doesn't always have to be direct democracy.
Chair Garrard, representing Nolan, yes.
Thank you.
Any further questions of this panel? Linda, did you want to speak now?
Just real quickly, Mr. Chair. Linda Ludwig from League of Oregon Cities. I think you've heard a lot of eloquent discussion, and you heard from me before. Lastly, what I would just like to bring to your attention again, a request. This issue is complex. It's multifaceted with all of us sitting here, and it escalates outside this room and outside the building.
We have requested that we do look at this issue during the interim, spend some time, focus some people, and bring back something to the next legislative session. And I would make that request again today.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, if I may do something that I've never done before, which is ask the approval to answer a question which I was not asked by Representative Greenlick.
Yes.
I thought about whether or not I should do this. I do want to comment on a question that he had earlier. He asked one of the other witnesses whether or not we'd support a moratorium, or all cities would support a moratorium on annexation. And I guess I wanted to provide the perspective just real quickly of the fast-growing cities who are my members. And I think that, you know, if we were talking about a limited moratorium on certain types of annexation, island annexations or things like that, maybe that's something we can discuss. I would, however, be hesitant to put a two-year moratorium on the ability of a city such as Prineville to annex new territory for a two-year period. Let me just give you an example. Prineville just spent, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of dollars on a 10-year UTB expansion process, comprehensive plan update. Actually, I haven't even finished the comprehensive plan update, but UTB expansion. They brought in what they thought would be about a 20-year supply for land for residential growth. That's about 1,000 acres. Within several months of that property being brought into the city, it was all bought up by developers who are going to develop it. And Mike Wendell, who's the mayor of Prineville, told me this past week that he expects that within 2, 3, 4, maybe 5 years at the most, that land will all be developed, and they will have no more land left over for development. So I guess my only caution, Representative, would be if there's some way to be flexible and allow certain kinds of annexations without putting a total moratorium on them all for a two-year period, that's something that I would like to discuss with you. Thank you.
Any response, Representative Williams?
Thank you. Yeah, this is the first time I've been on this side of the conversation. That question obviously had irony in it, and nobody in this panel has ever suggested that we slow down annexations that are voluntary annexations that people want to have happen. But it's just, what worries me, and you have some familiarity with Washington County, is that we say, let's slow down. And Beaverton is annexing a piece of property and then announcing a Walmart's going to be on it, to the consternation of all its neighbors. And I'm all for deliberation. I just don't want to have all the decisions we're deliberating about being done before the deliberation's over. Mm-hmm. So it was a point I was making, not that I really expected anybody in fact to propose or to accept the notion of absolute stopped annexation. But thanks for asking the question.
Thank you, panel, very much. Kathy Sales, Julie Russell, and Ken Henschel.
Acres in the South Shore will turn out to be urban location. So then we got a cocktail map from 5 and 37.
If you have written testimony and you're submitting that to the committee, please kind of give us the Reader's Digest. Don't sit there and just read it word for word. I think all of our committee members are literate enough to be able to read it. So I don't know who would like to begin.
My name is Kathy Sales. I live in the unincorporated area of Washington County, part of the area that was targeted last year by Tualatin Hills Park and Recreation District for an ORS 195 single majority annexation. In listening to the audio tape from last week, I understood from that I better not name the city that I live adjacent to. I think I'm supposed to be sensitive to the feelings of elected officials who are not the least bit sensitive to mine, because I am personally opposed to annexation. However, that city is represented by the symbol of a large rodent famous for its efficiency at cutting down trees. Actually, it's voting rights that bother me. I also watched and testified as I saw my neighbours on Bull Mountain go through the same thing as the city of Tigard tried to deprive them of an effective vote. The mayor of that city, claimed that if the unincorporated residents were given a free and decisive vote, they would disenfranchise the taxpayers of Tigard. I'm saving that one for a bumper sticker. I've also been involved in two annexation attempts 6 years ago by the Rodan City. But it was an islanding issue, which is different. Now, that city is 80,000. And they keep telling us that they expect it to be, they want it to be in 300,000. Count the numbers out, there are more of us in the unincorporated area by the time they're through with annexing us. So who is it that's seeking to disenfranchise whom? Now, just in case some people think that this is a recent issue, I'm talking 6 years here. I have spent a lot of my time in the past 6 years being put through the ringer with one annexation attempt following another. We do not need delays, we need the law fixed. These cities and jurisdictions claim that we will never freely agree to annex, and therefore, by their logic, they must force us. It's actually in the documents, and that's hard to believe. The government exists to serve the people. Or did I immigrate here from the medieval monarchy, in case you were wondering, in pursuit of an illusion? Thank you, Representative Greenleaf and Chair Garrow, for your responsiveness to the concerns of a huge group of people. It's not easy for ordinary people to grasp the process, or to use it effectively, or even to know what's going on. If you're lucky, you get a letter in the mail which says, "We are not your government, but we want to annex you. If you want information, call us." The perpetrator. We have nobody to go to who can give us the unbiased facts. We don't put up a good show, like some of these polished presenters, whose salaries are paid, by the way, by the taxpayers in the cities which want to swallow us whole. We talk about efficiency. Right now, I am concerned about efficiency of services, and specifically the discriminating use of my tax dollars. I don't see the cities providing that, quite the opposite. But they are quite efficient at distorting the picture. Our Sheriff Gordon, his predecessor, Jim Swindon, attempted to consolidate policing, to place several of our policing agencies under one head and eliminate efficiencies. My mayor, by aspiration, squashed it. We have water surface service in my unincorporated area, which buys bulk rent water. It's the best and most pristine water, ask whoever you will. They pay a lot for it, that agency does, but they mark it up just a little bit. The city, however, buys its water from a consortium, including a goodly proportion of the Trask River water. They buy it dirt cheap, and they mark it up one heck of a lot. So in the end, it's a wash. If this is for efficiency, we have better services. It's also fluoridated where we live. A lot of our parent population do not want to be annexed to a city which has inferior water. Of course, this is not about what one city does, but about the general theory and the practice of annexation as she is done. And I can tell you about that too. Subjected to, how can I put it to be fair, the one-sided view of the city. The reason for one of our annexation attempts, we were told, and I heard one of your speakers reiterate this last week, is that so the police know where the police can go and where they cannot. Well, our city adjacent had the good sense to drop that particular argument 6 years ago, because years before that turned out, there was an agreement between the various policing agencies which gives jurisdiction to any police officer anywhere in the state to respond to an event that's occurring. These distortions come up one after the other, until we regular folks manage to get sufficient publicity to put the lie to some small part of it. I've heard it said that city taxpayers pay for county services, but not the other way round. This is one falsehood that is particularly egregious. Our newspaper of wide circulation parrots this nonsense all the time. The effect is to bamboozle and deceive the regular citizen. One amongst you has fallen for it. These arguments have been repeated 5,000 times since Senate Bill 122 passed. It's in danger of becoming a fact. The Senate Bill, as you know, was nothing more than a document compelling jurisdictions to do their planning and stop the haggling. I've actually got an email from the sheriff of Washington County that says that 73% of the jail population comes from the cities. Yet those of us who live in the incorporated area are paying the same amount into the general fund as the city dwellers. Three quarters of the warrants are served within the city, yet we are paying for it. Only the city of Beaverton has a court, and they send people to the jail in the county, which we are paying for, $65 a night. This is not a one-sided thing. We are paying for the bulk of it. If the city needs extra help, all we have to do is call the sheriff. There's a whole bunch of the facts here that we hardly ever hear. Then there's the library issue. We all pay into that fund, even if we live in the incorporated area. And that fund goes to the state and it goes back to the libraries according to usage. What are we supposed to do? Stop using the libraries? It's absolute nonsense. If we stop using the libraries, it won't benefit anybody. But we are told we are parasites. When we use the library, or when we spend money on goods from businesses that pay taxes to the city, all we ever hear is fair share, who is paying the fair share. If we go shop in Seattle, are we parasites upon the merchants of Washington State? Now, we live on the periphery, those of us who are facing annexation. We always will. Our geography is not going to change. Why should we pay our taxes to a city we don't want to join, didn't elect their officials, who don't like their form of government, just because their poor decisions need our subsidy? That's what it's all about. I don't need to keep you here all day. I don't want to do that. But on the other hand, people like me are forced to spend a lot of time doing research if we are to find out the facts. There's no other way to get it. That's not fair. I've spent years studying it. And what they want to do is to force us because they have nothing to give us. One representative mentioned that we did elect our county commissioners who are supposed to represent us, but here's the rub, they also represent the city residents. We are the only ones not getting our interests served directly. Our interests are diluted by the political aspirations and the cronyism of these joint forces to serve only the city's agenda. There is no one but you left to represent us and our interests. We want to say in our government, we want an effective vote. I'm very concerned about the islands. I want to come and testify because I can raise your hair about the manner in which cities do try to island. I've had lawyers and stopped some pretty funny stuff going on, but it's a separate issue. Please do not water down this bill with amendments about the island situation. It needs fixing desperately. The islands need their own bill, and I'm all for that. Urban blight, it's a bunch of nonsense. There's a whole load of very high-value property out in an unincorporated area that was developed under the county process. That's why the cities want to annex them. There's a heck of a lot of property taxes in there. Septic tanks, it's a separate issue. It's nothing to do with the city of jurisdiction. I want to stress one thing before I shut up here. The single majority vote from ORS 195 is an interpretation, and here over and again, it's a tool. It's not a tool, it's a misinterpretation. It is also an abuse. The parks area, excuse me, when the park district tried their annexation, they wanted to annex all of the UGB, no exceptions, including the people who already paid for private services. Thank you. Now, Mr. Reese implies that development only occurs in cities. There's a great deal of this kind of talk going on. The counties also provide these services, and we like it the way it is. I'm going to stop here. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you for your testimony. That's a very attractive sweatshirt you have on.
Yeah.
It says Alcatraz on the front of it.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if you're delivering a message to this committee.
Well, I usually wear a t-shirt that has a sumo wrestler on it, which conveys a definite impression since it has a back view there, but I definitely was not trying to give you that signal today. I appreciate you are a county commissioner, were once, and there are some decent guys among them. So I thought I'd give you a little respect today. It's my respectful gift.
Thank you, Ms. Sales, very much. Ms. Russell?
Thank you, Chair Gerard and Vice Chair Anderson and Greenlick and committee members. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. And I don't have it in my testimony in written form yet, but I will. I just returned last night from a trip at 3 in the morning, so I haven't had a lot of time to type it up. I reside at 12662 Southwest Terraview Drive in the unincorporated area of Bull Mountain. And the first thing I want to start with is I want to dispute, because I disagree with some of the previous testimony here today. One of the things that someone testified to is that our county commissioners have the ability to veto an annexation at any point. That is absolutely not true. And our county commissioner, Roy Rogers, has said, in fact, that when the urban service agreements and the intergovernmental agreements are signed, the county's hands are tied as far as anything that they can do to override that annexation process. The other thing that I wanted to dispute was that there's low voter turnout regarding annexation issues. Bull Mountain, the unincorporated Bull Mountain area, had an approximately 86% turnout for the annexation. That was even more people than voted for the presidential race. And I don't believe at any point that this is low voter turnout. Another issue is the fact that they've said that annexation has included agreements and much dialogue and work between the counties, the cities, and the service districts, which is true. The fact of the matter, the thing that has been left out is the citizen involvement, which is required by state law. When the urban service agreement and the intergovernmental agreements were signed between Washington County and Tigard, RCPO 4B was inactive. The only person that information was sent to was Bev Rowdy, who doesn't have a computer, and those documents went in her closet. They went to no one else. So as far as the citizen involvement, there was none. The other thing is I wanted to dispute the fact that I think it's very unfair for there not to be a double majority vote, even though I live in the unincorporated area and would probably benefit from only the unincorporated areas being able to vote. I look at my neighbors and friends in the cities and believe that they should have a right to weigh in on annexations also. Tigard's annexation plan, Bull Mountain Community Plan, stated that it would cost approximately $36 million to bring Bull Mountain area up to city standards. I think the citizens of Tigard should have a right to say whether or not they want to pay for those improvements. I believe the League of Oregon Cities wants to study this issue and not do anything until the next session in 2 years. I think most of the areas that are already in the urban service areas would already be annexed, and it will be too late. I know that Washington County is currently studying to see if city residents are subsidizing county residents or vice versa. There's been much dialogue in the media that city residents subsidize the county residents, but there's no proof to back that up, and Chair Tom Bryan has now understands that and wants that to be studied. I've been involved with this process for the past year and a half. It's been a very long, involved process, and I've learned much and been frustrated in many ways. I do not oppose annexation, and in the very beginning of this, we as residents of Bull Mountain undertook this process because we wanted to be involved in it and have some say in how this annexation was going to take place. We became committee members to the White Papers, and then we learned that the City of Tigard really had no intention of making any of those recognized part of the annexation plan.
The only thing that the city council did was acknowledge that those papers took place. Never did they agree to give us anything for the work that we've done on those committees. Only at the last minute, when we, as Friends of Bull Mountain, had to hire our attorney, Larry Durr, spend $30,000 of our own money, did the city of Tigard decide to switch to a double majority vote and pass 7 last-minute resolutions to entice the residents to vote for the annexation. It still failed. We feel that if this had been a requirement from the very beginning, the city of Tigard would have engaged in conversation, open dialogue, with the residents of Bull Mountain to actually engage us and ask us what would be acceptable to us, what would be agreeable for us to be annexed. We now are in negotiations with Washington County and some of the city of Tigard city council to say, okay, what can we do now to make this work? We aren't opposed to this, but we are opposed to the way that you've been doing it. One of the things that we've recently discovered is that the intergovernmental agreements and the urban service agreements gave Tigard the authority to collect the traffic impact fees since 1997. That was millions of dollars. That money was supposed to be spent in the urban service area. Not 1 cent of that currently has. It's been spent in Tigard. And so for the city of Tigard to say that we're not paying our fair share, we're tired of that dialogue. And it isn't true. We don't believe that Tigard is the most efficient provider of urban services. Washington County provides all of our service except for parks. When we dialogue with Tigard, and they annexed many areas of Bull Mountain, a third of the mountain is already part of Tigard, that collected millions of dollars in system development fees for parks. None of that has been spent on Bull Mountain. We have no parks, we have no trails, and we have no safe streets in order to walk. We have had dialogue with Washington County and Tigard to ask if we could be annexed to Tualatin Hills Park and Rec District. We were told from Tigard and our elected official in Washington County that Tigard would block any attempt to do that. So not only were we blocked from providing our own services or annexing to another park district, we were told that they would also prevent us from forming our own special service district for parks. The planning and comprehensive planning issue now, and Roy Rogers, our county commissioner, said his hands are tied, that neither the county nor Tigard wants to provide planning for Bull Mountain. So they both point fingers at each other and say that neither one wants to pay for it. The other issue that we found out recently by reading the Urban Service Agreement and the Intergovernmental Agreement is that the Washington County has reimbursed the city of Tigard for all costs related to the annexation. So not only were we opposed to the annexation, we were also paying for it. And I believe that's an unfair use of our money. So just to wrap it up, and I appreciate your listening and hearing and having another hearing on this opportunity, I want to urge you to pass House Bill 2484 in its current state without amendments to protect the double majority vote, because I believe that's the only way there's going to be free and open dialogue between the residents and the cities who want to annex them. Thank you.
We'll save our questions when the final member of the panel speaks, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. My name is Ken Hinchel. I previously testified at the February 16th hearing as Vice Chair of Citizen Participation Organization 4B. Today I'm testifying as a citizen. I would wholeheartedly agree with the previous two speakers. They crystallized a lot of my thoughts. I have a bit additional to that. I look at the armed services of the U.S. fighting Iraq right now. We've lost many lives, close to 1,500, to help the people of Iraq to hold, for the first time, free and fair elections to determine by whom they will be governed. Yet here we are back at home in Oregon debating the same issue. It seems surreal to me that the right to a fair election should ever be open to debate here in Oregon. It seems that the opponents of this bill are clouding the issue by introducing unrelated annexation topics, as well as the unrelated issues of tax equity and expediency. House Bill 2484, the way it is presently written, and again, I have not had the advantage prior to coming today to see any amendments, the way it is presently written is very precise and very clear. It simply and neatly cleans up an ambiguity in ORS 195 to give all communities a fair vote in annexations. Period. I believe that's the way it should stay. Some opponents of this bill think that a single majority annexation vote is inherently fair. I disagree. By way of example, I ask you to consider
a hypothetical scenario. What if the state of California, in an effort to gain badly needed water, offered to combine statehood with the state of Oregon, forming a single state called California, with their existing government, their tax structure, their laws, and their customs? In a fair vote, would you, our Oregon legislators, rather A, see the votes of Oregon's 2 million registered voters combined with the votes of California's 17 million registered voters in a winner-take-all scenario? In this scenario, your 2 million possible votes would likely be lost in the shuffle of what would pour California's 17 million possible votes. Or B, have the citizens of Oregon vote on the issue, and separately, have the citizens of California vote on the issue, with both elections having to affirm the annexation before it were to move forward. Unless you want to be working hand-in-hand with Governor Schwarzenegger in Sacramento and have your state tree as the California redwood and your state insect as the California dog-faced butterfly, I think that the choice that Oregonians would prefer is very clear. The double majority vote would preserve Oregon's right to choose its government. In my local community, the city of Tigard recently attempted to annex my smaller Bow Mountain community using a single majority provision. With Tigard voters having 6-1 numerical superiority over unincorporated Bow Mountain voters, that single majority vote would have been as fair as 6 wolves and 1 lamb voting together on what to have for dinner. Fortunately, common sense in the form of the double majority provisions of ORS 268 prevailed, and I remain a happy unincorporated Bow Mountain lamb instead of an unhappy Tigard lamb chop. Please, representatives, I ask three things. Please side with fairness and send HB 2484 to the floor with a unanimous due pass. Please don't water down this excellent bill with unrelated annexation issues and amendments. Keep the bill and its purpose simple and clear as it presently is. And please don't delay this decision. A delay will only prolong the inevitable and could seriously hurt Oregonians. And finally, please make this permanent. In a basic issue of voting rights, I don't know that we need a short-term solution with a chance to look at it again down the road. I think this needs to be permanent. It's a voter rights issue. Thank you for hearing my testimony today and for your work in correcting an ambiguity in ORS 195 to preserve fair voting practices for all Oregonians.
Thank you. Any questions of this panel? Thank you all very much. And our final panel will bring up Bob Keith, Isadora Margavi, Charles Ormsby, and Jim Law. Keith, would you like to start off?
Empty chair.
Oh, okay.
Who's Bob Keith?
Apparently Bob's not here, so we'll go to Isadora. And I know you, so.
Chairman Gerard, members, first of all, let me apologize for a weakness, my personal weakness. I do tend to get emotional at times, okay? And I want to tell you that wrapping myself in the American flag and democracy is something that is very deep-rooted in me. I spent the Korean War shelling ammunition from Japan to Korea. My oldest son put 3 terms as a U.S. Marine in Vietnam. Thank God he came home. I have a granddaughter in Vietnam, in Iraq today. And every night when I watch the Jim Lehrer News Hour and there's that small ending portion of the people who we lost over there, that usually brings a tear to my eye. So I do tend to get somewhat emotional, and I do intend to wrap myself in the American flag every opportunity that presents itself. I have a prepared testimony, but first I'd like to offer some prayers, some ad-lib.
Well,
can you be as brief as possible, please?
I will.
Thank you.
You asked Representative Gerard, do the city taxpayers, are their taxes affected by annexation? And the answer to that is yes, in that specifically in Tigard, we have a huge bond issue there that was voted in by the citizens of Tigard. We have nothing to say on that. Yet if we were annexed into the city, we would pay on that bond issue. So anytime there is a bond issue in the city, and other people are annexed into it, all the citizens will pay into that bond issue. So there is a benefit to these city dwellers on that issue. Representative Greenlick, you asked the question about would you hold up for a moratorium, and you got somewhat of an evasive answer. I attended the annexation symposium held at Metro last week, and I broached that same subject to Mayor Rob Drake. His answer was very firm and very prompt and very no. Jack Hoffman made a good deal of the background and the legal precedents of how we got where we are, and I'm certainly not going to touch that. But we do have a problem, because at that same symposium, County Administrator Charlie Cameron from Washington County, the Administrator from Clackamas County, and the Lake Oswego City Manager all put on presentations, all of which agreed that there is a problem. In summation, what was said that the land use laws and stuff you're dealing with now that was promulgated 20-some years ago could not have anticipated the Measure 5, the Measure 47, Measure 50, and now the Measure 38 impact. We have a land use issue that is really more or less a taxation issue, because what we face as potential Tigard residents when the annexation was attempted in November, we were going to have our taxes increased. So there's a very clear taxation by annexation, and all of this annexation activity has started up in the past few years, and I don't think it's an accident that the Tigard 5-year budget forecast was going nice and flat, and then started to do this. And when it started to do this, that they got real anxious about annexation, because Bull Mountain represented what I call a significant cash cow, with the much higher than usual average property value and extremely low maintenance cost. It was almost like going out and buying dollar bills for 50 cents. That was what all that was about. And I won't bother you anymore with that. In my prepared statement, I would ask that you look at the third paragraph, second sentence, and strike all that is within the parentheses known to many as Drakeson. That is inappropriate, and I apologize. At the risk of stating the obvious, I would like you to know that I and my colleagues who support the democratic process of the double majority vote have put in a lot of work and spent a lot of time and money without any compensation or reward. Much as was done many years ago when others like us threw a whole lot of tea in Boston Harbor. For over a year, residents of the unincorporated area of Bull Mountain tried to engage the city of Tigard in a dialogue about livability issues such as densities, parks, SDCs, green spaces, and sidewalks. At no time did Dirksen or any other members of the council afford us even the courtesy of pretending to hear what we were saying. There was no dialogue. They sat there like so many bobbleheads, paying only attention to the timer to be sure that we did not exceed the time allowed.
Mr. McGarvey, are you going to read your testimony?
No, sir. I am going to thank you for your except for this last paragraph, which is a quote from someone we all know, should all know, Winston Spencer Stuart from Churchill. And he said, "It is a mistake to look too far in the future. The chain of destiny can only be grasped one link at a time." Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McGarvey. Charlie?
Charles Orsby. And will Linda Hamilton Trix please come up and take Mr. McGarvey's seat? My apologies, somehow I overlooked your name in the last group, so I apologize for that.
Good afternoon, Representative Girard, Representative Smith, and Representative Anderson. Thank you for affording me this second opportunity to testify on House Bill 2484. In essence, I would commend the committee to do as Ken Henschel said, is to pass this bill unanimously to the floor. I'm very impressed. This is my first time dealing with the legislative, and very impressed with the nuances in the balance of things. A couple of comments I have on the ORS 195 annexation process. I was subjected to it in the Lake Oswego Urban Growth Management Area in 2003, as Councillor Jack Hoffman testified to. First off, this evolved from about 2003, from St. Patty's Day, that somebody proposed to use ORS 195 to a proposed election date of 2003 in November. There was no plan of annexation proper to the people. There are no inter-service agreements, to my knowledge, that were established between for Birds Hill area of who was to do what, when, how, and where, and why. In fact, that so the citizen participation was not effective. And I'm saying this as a resident of that area subjected to that process. And I think the 195 process, as stated with the single majority, does not provide an effective means of doing so. There's no feedback from the people to the government, in essence saying, is this a good plan and is this a good process? And I think with the double majority, that does provide that check and balance at the local level, which is sorely needed at this time. The other issue is the issue of cost. I think that issue is raising its head very fast, and I would commend the cities for Washington County for trying to get a handle on it. I think the cost issue should be investigated and accounting systems be adjusted to get that resolution to the neighborhood accounting level so that you can find out what the cost of a call is to Birds Hill versus downtown Lake Oswego. So people can say, is this a good thing or a bad thing? Let's see. As far as the speed and delay of doing this, presenting this legislation, deferring it out 2 years, right now there's no check and balance afforded to the people in unincorporated areas throughout the state. That check doesn't need to be put in place as fast as possible, in my opinion, because we estimated in Birds Hill to contend Chapter ORS 195 annexation would be in the neighborhood of $100,000 to $200,000 in legal fees. A lot of people cannot afford that type of money. And that's about all I have at this time. Thank you.
Mr. Wong?
Good afternoon, committee. I'm going to try and go as fast as I can. My name's Jim Long. I live in unincorporated Washington County near North Plains. I've been involved with OCVA. I'm a member of the Friends of North Plains. I'm not speaking for either group. I just want to give you some understanding of a little bit of the background of my interest for the last few years. The number one goal for land use in the state of Oregon is citizen participation. There are many good reasons for this. The double majority vote will foster citizen participation so that people have an equal and fair way to convey their attitudes. Voters in the city of North Plains are the only voters in Oregon to twice approve a city charter amendment to require voter approval of annexation of city limits. It is fair to require approval by both city voters, the annexers, and the annexees, their neighbors, prior to any changes in jurisdictional taxation limits, because their interests may be different and they need to be measured separately, counted separately, and approved separately. I believe that public participation is essential for the process of conservation and development in Oregon. I want to cite a couple of things quickly. The 30 communities that have changed their city charters so that the citizens have a voice and can vote on annexations. It's my understanding that there have been a dozen votes. 11 of them approve the annexation. So the fear that this is going to, that the votes are going to cause lots of negativity and voting down on annexations is somewhat misfounded. I think that there's something to see in there. Only one more point. A couple of points I want to make. Living in North Plains, there's an annexation issue there now. They actually have two areas, one north of the city and one east of the city. And it's confusing as to whether we're going to have two votes or one vote. And that's a fairly important consideration. The other thing of interest, it goes a little bit off the topic here for just a second. The developer there has proposed a two-tiered taxation system so that the 150 or 700 houses in the new subdivision would pay twice as much in taxes as the old North Plains. I don't think it's going to be legal, and I think it's a way of trying to get the voters to try and approve this thing, and I think it would cause a lot of problems to try and have two different taxation structures. I think it would be challenged and overturned very quickly. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
This committee spent a lot of time on North Plains in the last session, so it's good to hear from you, Andy.
Yeah, I testified last session a little, too.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chairman Girard and committee members. My name is Lisa Hamilton Trike, and I live in unincorporated Bull Mountain. I was here at the last committee meeting, and I really appreciate the opportunity to come back again and speak to you. Since I'm bringing up the rear here, a lot of what I have to say has already been said, and so I've taken some notes, and I want to hit on some highlights and kind of reinforce a few comments, but forgive me, this seems a little disjointed, but I want to be respectful of your time and all the time everybody spent here. What I have brought today is a one-page testimony from actually my neighbor and very good friend, Kashmira McVeigh. She and I have been involved in this issue in regards to Tiger since day one, about 18 months ago, once we became aware of what Tiger was trying to do with a single majority vote. Kashmira is actually a lawyer, and she's not practicing at this time. She's a government official and has experience in land use. And I just want to hit a couple of the highlights of her testimony because I agree completely with what she has to say. She's not opposed to annexation and effective land use planning tools for local governments, but she urges that you swiftly clarify that ORS 195 would require a double majority vote, because the double majority vote ensures that local governments actually plan for the urbanization of unincorporated areas. Without a double majority vote, cities will take what is to their advantage, which has been our experience on Bull Mountain, additional revenues from development fees, and dispense with their obligations of providing land use planning and urban services. Failure to clarify that ORS 195 requires a double majority vote will turn an effective land use tool into a contorted regulatory scheme that inequitably silences the very residents that will suffer the greatest impact. And there's an example that's been alluded to by a couple of folks from Bull Mountain today, and it's a great concern to me. And I had been trying to look into this issue a year ago, and it has just been in the last few weeks that I've received even just a little bit of information about it. And it has to do with traffic impact fees collected on unincorporated Bull Mountain under the Washington County Tiger Urban Service Agreement. And It appears that just in the last 2 years alone, nearly $800,000 was collected on unincorporated Bull Mountain and used to improve roads in the city of Tigard. If you read the Urban Service Agreement, that is in direct violation of what the requirements were. And there is a map attached to the Urban Service Agreement that defines the area. That's very, very troublesome to me. I'm very concerned about that, and I think we all should be. So anyway, that's just a brief summary of Kashmira McVeigh's comments. I've also included for your review from Richard Fransky, his testimony that he presented at the July 27th public hearing. There were two public hearings in Tigard, one in December of 2003 and one in July of 2004 on the annexation issue. 200 people, returning people, turned up at each of those public hearings. Approximately 3 dozen people testified at each. In each situation, only one person
testified in favor of the single majority annexation vote, and a number of the people who testified were Tigard residents, and they felt it was very unfair. Mr. Fransky, who is an attorney with Stoll Reeves, took the urban service agreement and went page by page and identified the areas that he sees as significant flaws in the annexation plan. And so he's provided a cover letter, and he asks that the committee approve House Bill 2484, ensuring the double majority vote on annexation. What he states is that we saw the Tigard annexation attempt as clear proof that double majority is sound public policy. The city's hollow annexation plan was prepared when Tigard believed it could annex Bull Mountain with a single majority vote. When it learned a double majority vote was necessary, it rushed to hang ornaments on the annexation tree. Had the city been forced to consider the needs and concerns of the affected citizens earlier, an acceptable plan may have been developed. And so I know this is a lengthy document, but I encourage you to take a look at it. And if you also would like to review the Bull Mountain Annexation Plan, there's a web address attached to this. I think one of the biggest problems in regards to what happened on Bull Mountain is that an urban service agreement was signed in 1997 without public involvement and absolutely no requirement for planning. In 1983, Bull Mountain had a beautiful comprehensive community plan done through the county with citizen involvement when the CPO was active. And that should be the operative plan for Bull Mountain. In 1997, Tigard took over Bull Mountain, and it was upzoned to 7 units per acre. There was absolutely no comprehensive planning done to blend the city of Tigard's comprehensive plan and Bull Mountain's comprehensive plan. So I think that's one of the most serious fatal flaws in the whole urban service process, is it does not require planning to happen, and the residents are stuck. The city says we don't invest outside of our city limits, and the county says it's not our problem, we're turning you over to the city and we don't have the money to do it. We have discussed trying to collect funds for ourselves to pay for our own plan. And we have been denied that opportunity, along with the requests to fund our own parks, to explore annexation to Tualatin Hills Park and Rec District. So that is seriously, seriously park deficient. So the urban service agreement not only denies people a fair vote, it also denies them an opportunity to participate in solving the problems in their own communities and paying for those problems themselves if they would like to. So let me just, excuse me, just a second. I don't want to miss a few of the highlights here. The Bull Mountain Community Plan is a beautiful plan, and we would love to see that put in place. Tigard requires gridded streets. Tigard is flat. Bull Mountain is a 720-foot high mountain, and the streets on Bull Mountain are, by Tigard's codes, required to be grid streets. Bull Mountain Community Plan requires that the streets follow the contour of the mountain, which only seems logical to me. So there's a serious conflict, and I'm just giving you this as one small example of the many conflicts that are going on. I don't know if many of you are familiar with Bull Mountain, if you remember it from years ago, a beautiful place to live. I think that your jaws would drop if you saw what's happening on Bull Mountain today. I've heard discussions that not having the double majority vote is an impediment to planning and being able to annex these areas. Tigard made a commitment to take Bull Mountain one way or the other, one bite at a time if they had to. And it's a pretty unfriendly approach if you wanted to complete your community with the residents of Bull Mountain. But I would like to show you, this just came out in our CPO newsletter the other day. It's 15 properties that are proposed for development just within this last month. It involves 450 brand new homes and 90 to 100 acres of development. That's about 25% of the undeveloped land left in unincorporated Bull Mountain, which is about two-thirds of the mountain, not including the new urban growth boundary areas. Like Mr. Decker said, the sky isn't falling. Tigard is continuing to annex. The problem is there's no planning. Planning is critical, and we can't seem to be given a way to do that. And you know, the final insult is the single majority vote. And I firmly believe we can all do better than that. And the double majority vote is the only thing that requires people to get together and figure this out in a better way. A lot is at stake here.
A lot of us have invested an incredible amount of time the last 18 months, and not to mention the amount of money that we've also spent. We don't have staff. We're not on salaries. We're doing this in what little bits and pieces of spare time that we have. And really the best way to give the citizens in an unincorporated territory a say is to require a double majority vote. And I would please ask that you swiftly move the bill forward as is. And, let's firm up fairness in Oregon. And that's what I thought it was all about. So thank you very much for your time.
Any questions of this panel? Certainly have to commend the people of Bull Mountain, because your representation to this committee has been very, very effective. I mean, you folks have come in here and you're to be, in my opinion, commended for taking a part of the process and being here. This is what it is all about, is having a voice and taking advantage of the opportunity to speak is an important one. And I just congratulate all of you for taking on the process, because it's not easy.
We appreciate your job, but you're doing a little bit more.
Well, we appreciate you folks too, and it's so noted that the city of Tigard nor the mayor of Beaverton have made an appearance before this committee.
Thank you,
panel, very much. We appreciate your
thank you for your kind comments. Yes.
And we will see no further.
Let me just make a very brief comment.
Certainly, Representative. I would not ever want to deny you a brief comment.
Thank you, sir. I'll be very brief. I've been getting a lot of mail from the Tiger folks saying, move this bill exactly as it is and move it fast. Our process really is a mixture of politics and policy. And ultimately, if we can get things out of the committee and then out of the House and then out of the Senate committee and then out of the Senate and then to the governor and then signed by the governor, it takes patience and it takes compromise. And what I think we're all very much involved in is understanding where we're trying to go, understanding how we're trying to protect citizens, and trying to work out something over time, over the short time, that can actually be moved forward and gain the political consent and ultimately be passed. That is going to take, I think, some compromise along the way, and I think what you can be assured is that we all very much are hearing what you're saying, and we all very much have the objective, or many of us have that objective clearly in mind, to protect those interests. You don't have to trust us that we're going to try and find the best way to do it that will actually get us where you want to be. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Representative Pamela, thank you very much. Seeing no further business, the Committee on Land Use is adjourned.